knowledge. They are not two alternative paths that all of us have to follow. The two paths, the path of work comes first, followed by the path of knowledge, because a certain amount of fitness is necessary to follow the path of knowledge, and that fitness comes through the path of work. A certain amount of fitness is necessary even to do the path of work. It's not like by default we are ready. For instance, sometimes when we speak about non-duality or Advaita, and there is a tendency to think that dualism is at the lower level, then there is qualified dualism and there is Advaita. And so, while many accept that non-dualism is very high, the experience of oneness, but somehow the popular misconception is that we are all dualists now, and that's kind of a default mode, which is not true. It's not like in order to be a dualist we don't need to do anything. We are not even dualists, most of us, because in order to be a dualist, it's not simply saying, oh, okay, there is God. Whether you are a dualist or a non-dualist or whatever, the first thing is a firm conviction that God is there, God exists. And then, unless we have had that firm conviction in the presence of God, we may have different ideas about what is the nature of God. That's different. But first of all, whether God is there or not. And when can we say that we have a firm conviction that God is there? A firm conviction that God is there would mean that no matter what we do in life, God is always a part of our thinking, a part of the mental calculation. It's like this. Suppose in a family, say there are 3 or 4 or 5 people living in a home, at home. Now if you make any plans to say, okay, we are going to now move, or we are going to now go on a picnic, you normally think about what the repercussions of that decision is going to be on every member of the family, right? Because you know that there are 5 members, and if anything that is decided, it's going to affect all the 5 members. And if you say don't consider one person at all within the family, that means you don't even acknowledge the presence of that person. Exactly in the same way, since we acknowledge the presence of every member of our family, we are conscious about how our decisions will affect the members of the family. Now if we acknowledge the presence of God in our lives, how often do we acknowledge that how my actions and thoughts are going to affect the presence of God? Well, we might discover that other than the times when we go to a temple, or other than the times when we specifically come to discuss a spiritual subject, God is not even a part of our mental makeup. And that's why we divide our life into this is secular and this is spiritual. And so we don't think that God has any business to do when I go for my work. That's my work. There's nothing to do. When I go to a temple, of course, that's about God. But my workplace is nothing. Why should God interfere there? Unless, of course, there is some problem at the workplace. Then I pray to God. But if there is no problem, if things are just fine, then God can be a problem. You see, so because if you are having a great time and there is no problem at all, then the thought of God can be an obstacle actually. Because then you think, you know, suppose like you are having a great time. Then you say, oh, now it's time for my meditation. Now it's time for arati. And then you think, oh my God, if I had not thought about it, I could have still continued to have fun. So when there is no problem, God can be a problem. So God, oftentimes we use God as a kind of a 911. We don't normally call 911 just for fun. Only if there is some crisis. Now, can we use God as just a backup in let me try all other things, solution. If nothing works, then as a backup, God is always there. If we do that, then we are not acknowledging the presence of God. And so first of all, even in order to be a dualist, we are, that is why I say we are not even dualist, because a true dualist always acknowledges that God is present. And therefore, it's not like you don't need any spiritual experience to be a dualist. So even in a path of dualism, you need a genuine spiritual experience to feel God's presence. That is why Swami Turiyananda, a great disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, used to say, a dualist with spiritual experience is better than a non-dualist with no experience. So people can talk this high philosophy and write big books on it, but if they have not experienced anything in life, that is useless. Compared to some very humble person who may not talk high philosophy, but have had some, even if it's a dualistic experience, something. So that is first thing to remember. And therefore, even in order to be fit for the path of karma, there's some amount of fitness is necessary. Then we do karma in a way it needs to be done. Then we become fit for knowledge. And it is knowledge that will free us. Because the problem of the human problem is a problem of ignorance or avidya or ajnana. And that avidya or ajnana can be removed only by jnana. Just like darkness. Suppose there is darkness, then a darkness can be removed only by light. Darkness cannot be removed by shouting. Oh, light, 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 light. You keep on shouting, it won't come. Actual light must come to remove that darkness. So similarly, since the problem is ignorance, the solution is knowledge. And so that is why Krishna said, the verses that we saw this morning, that there are two paths. Path of knowledge, path of work. Some are fit for the path of work, some are fit for the path of knowledge. The fitness for the path of knowledge comes by doing our work in a proper way. Now, the next set of verses, beginning from the 9th, will discuss an important aspect called yajna. Now, the popular notion of yajna, of course, is that you set up a fire and put some ghee and whatever things in it. But that's only a ritualistic way of affirming a larger truth. And yajna really means that everything in this world is cyclical. Everything comes in cycles. Everything goes in cycles. We see, for instance, now rain. How does rain come? The simplistic explanation, the basic is essentially there is already water, then that water evaporates, it goes up, and then it condenses and falls again. So it's really, it's the sun which draws up the moisture, and then it goes up, and then the whole thing falls again. So a circle is completed, and then the water evaporates again. Same thing with all natural processes are all cyclical. The seasons, they come and go. Every year you have a winter, then followed by summer and fall and so on. Days and nights, they follow one another. And that's how the whole process is repeated even in the human cycle. So we know that a baby is born, then there is childhood, then there is grows up a little, then there is teenager, then in middle age, old age, and then dies, and then again reborn. So everything is in circle. Now this yajna that is popular, the ritualistic yajna that was done, was an act of gratitude. That is, what the Hindus did was, they saw the entire world as alive. It was not simply just a play of atoms and molecules, just a material world, but the world was alive by the presence of God. So everything was alive. And so every natural process was alive with consciousness, Chaitanya. And so they personified these natural processes. So rain was not simply just a purely materialistic, scientific view would be just what I explained earlier. Here is this water, then goes and comes down. But since they saw the entire creation as alive by the presence of God, they saw that there was some intelligence behind all of this. And so that consciousness associated with rain, they personified it. And then that became the god of rain. And they gave it a name, Indra. And so then they said, oh, it's through Indra's grace that the rain comes. It's not that they were ignorant about the scientific process. Some of the greatest scientists, they were come, if you see in ancient India. So they knew how things happened. Long before even Western astronomy developed, if you see some of the works of that Aryabhatta, Bhaskara, amazing calculations. We don't even know how, you know, they didn't have any of these modern instruments and things like that. But they never had any doubt that it is the earth that goes around the sun. That's why they could predict the eclipses and everything. Centuries before it, modern science even got hold of it. But with that, in spite of that knowledge, they also saw the earth as alive. And so the offering that was done in a fire, that was a symbolical way of expressing gratitude. That it is through the grace of Indra that the rain comes. So I offer this to Indra. And so in return, then Indra will give this to me. And I am grateful again, so I offer more to Indra. Some of you may have seen a lot of the Vedic elaborate rituals have kind of now no more been practiced, not even possible to do so. But some of these remnants are still there in the current way the puja is done. So sometimes in that Homa ceremony you might have seen there's a small cup at the side. And so every offering you do, say Idam Namama, Indraya Swaha, Idam Namama, Varunaya Swaha, Idam Namama. So Idam Namama means this is not mine. But all offerings began with Agnaya Swaha, offering to fire. Now fire was considered a kind of a Vedic postman. That is, I mean, you are offering to Indra, but what is Indra's address and who is going to deliver this offering to Indra? So since everything that was put in fire in the form of smoke, it went up. And generally, in the human imagination, up is a place where all these celestials live. And so fire was considered as a UPS. And of course you know that it is said that one day one mother sent her little boy and said, go to the shop and buy some sweets. And so bring 1 pound of laddus. And so this fellow goes and brings. And then the mother sees, it looks very small quantity. And she says, oh, just because I sent my little boy, that shopkeeper has cheated him. So she goes angry to the shop and says, just because I sent my little boy, you have given small kind, have you weighed these laddus properly? And the shopkeeper says, ma'am, I have weighed the laddus properly. Have you weighed your son properly? So on the way back, he has eaten some. That's why the amount is looking little small. So that is why now, if you want somebody to deliver, say, suppose you want to ask a little boy, go to that home and give these sweets. Now, if you don't want that fellow to eat something on the way, better to give him something first. You eat here well, so when that fellow is fed, then he won't steal on the way. So that is what they did. Now, this fire is going to deliver all this to these different gods. Now, what if now the fire gets hungry and packs up on it? So the first offering that's done is to fire. You take Agnaya Swaha. You eat well, then one by one you deliver it. So the yajna, that's only a ritualistic way of expressing gratitude to the natural forces. But that ritual only points to a deeper reality. And that is, just as rain and food and everything comes, but we are also receiving a lot of things in our own lives. For instance, the care, understanding, love, sacrifice, which we all received. All of us, they say a human baby is the most helpless creature that's ever born. If you see even some birds and animals, within a short time they become independent. They can do things on their own. But a human baby for months and months is like so much dependent. And we know that how much the parents have to pass sleepless nights, care for the baby, there is so much sacrifice involved. And therefore, we have a lot to be grateful for in life. But to be grateful to those who brought us up, we have to be grateful to our teachers. How many of our teachers, beginning from your kindergarten to school and college and wherever you studied, the education that we received, the friendship that we have received from our friends, the love that we have received. Now all that this has come from the world, and I said everything is cyclical, everything should go around. So when we extend friendship and love and understanding to others, we are only passing out to others what we have received from others. So nothing is our own. That is the first thing that we learn in Yajna, is nothing. I mean, when we came into this world, what did we come with? Nothing. We did not bring a penny with us. And when we leave, we are not going to take anything either. So in between this period, from the time we are born till the time we die, in between, we suddenly start grasping and say, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine. But really, nothing is ours. We did not come here with anything. We are going to go away with nothing. So the ideal life, a life that will bring joy, fulfillment and peace, is a life that learns to share. That recognizing that all I am today is because of the things that I have received from nature, things that I have received from my friends, my relatives, my family. All of them have contributed to me, to be me being who I am. And now, everything that has come to me, I must pass it on. So when we do something for the world, we are not doing any favor to anybody. Because nothing was mine to begin with. I am only passing on to others what came to me from others. So completing that circle is our individual yajna. Then there is a divine yajna. There is an ancient Vedic hymn called Purusha Sukta, in which it is said this Virata Purusha, the cosmic divine being, sacrificed. So in the parts of the body of that being, this entire world came. And so there is, that is the cosmic sacrifice of the divine being. Then there is the individual sacrifice that we do. Plus there is a sacrifice involved in the natural processes. So these yajnas are continually going on everywhere. Now if anybody says, everybody should give me, but I am not going to give anything to anybody, then we are trying to block that free passage of things that come to us. It's like this, for instance now. So you open the windows, a lot of fresh air comes. And suppose there is a door here and there is a door here. So fresh air comes from here and fresh air goes out there. And if the more it goes out, the more fresh air comes in. But if you say, oh, I want the fresh air, but I don't want to share this fresh air with anybody. So as soon as the fresh air comes, you close all the doors and windows. What happens? This fresh air is no more going to remain fresh. You see? So that's what happens. When things come and we refuse to share it with other people, then it becomes, the whole environment inside becomes very corrosive, becomes very polluted, and such people suffer. Furthermore, it's not like we can even keep things. If we don't give willingly, nature will force us to give. So if something has to be given anyway, why not do it willingly? That's the, because I mean, if it was possible to keep everything to ourselves, then at least it's worth trying. But when we know that it's not possible, if it is something inevitable, why not do it joyfully? You see? Now that is what yajna is. So I just wanted to give you this background about yajna. Because now when we read these verses, then it will become clear. So this is what, so yajna simply does not mean putting things in a fire. That's only a very symbolical ritual. But behind it is all these cosmic cyclical processes that are going on. So now let's read verse number 9. यज्ञार्थात् कर्मणोऽन्यत्र लोकोऽयं कर्मबन्धनः तदर्थं कर्म कौन्तेय मुक्तसंगसमाचर
मुक्तसंगसमाचर.
The world is bound by actions other than those performed for the sake of yajna. Do therefore, O son of Kunti, earnestly perform action for yajna alone, free from attachment. So if you do every work as a form of yajna, as a form of completing that cycle, you will not get attached. You will become an instrument through which things just pass and things get cleaned. But the moment you try to stop that flow, then attachment comes, and with attachment will come pain and sorrow. So we must become like open channels through which, and because as I said, the more things go out from you, the fresh things will come. But if you stop it, then not even what is incoming will stop, and what you have you are going to lose. So that is what is meant by. So world is bound by actions. If we do things without the spirit of yajna, you are going to get bound by it. And all bondage is painful. Verse 10. Saha yajna praja srishtva puro vacha prajapatihi anena prasavishyadvam Having created mankind in the beginning together with yajna, the Prajapati said, by this shall you propagate, this shall be the milk cow of your desires. That is, when Prajapati, the Brahma, we're just not talking about Brahma before we started this, who projected this universe, along with it came this whole thing about yajna. And the idea was, whoever followed yajna, the spirit of yajna, they will live in happiness and through harmony. Whoever doesn't do it is going to get into trouble. 11. Devan bhavayata nena
Devan bhavayata nena
Te deva bhavayantu vaha Parasparam bhavayantaha
Parasparam bhavayantaha
Shreyaf paramavapsyatha
Shreyaf paramavapsyatha.
Cherish the devas with this, and may those devas cherish you. Thus cherishing one another, you shall reap the supreme good. So the devas here, as I said, are the personification or the powers of nature. It is the devas that unfortunately the 17th, 18th, 19th century Indologists, including Max Muller and others, who went and translated these Eastern texts in English, they often translated the devas as gods. And of course there are many devas, so became many gods. And opposed to this one god with a capital G, these gods became gods with small g. And then you have this whole problem about this one god as one true god and these worshippers of many false gods. All problem came just because translating the deva, I mean, deva simply means a shining one, a celestial being, which is only a personifying the power of nature. And so anyway, so that's, so I'm very happy that this book at least translated simply as devas without making them gods. Vivekananda used to say that, so you hear about this Indra, as you know, this Hindu mythology had all these devas, Indra, Varuna and all of that. And Vivekananda once pointed out that this doesn't refer to any particular person. Indra is not a specific person in some heaven. Indra is the name of a post. It's like the Secretary of State or the Defense Secretary. Now that's not a name of a person. When different administrations come, there will be a different Secretary of State. So there will always be a Secretary of State, but the person filling that position will not be the same. So there will always be an Indra, there will always be these different devas, but they are only in the names of positions. So now, when people die and they go to heaven And so they are, some of them are saying, okay, I think you are good at waterworks, so you go be an Indra for a while. So it's good to know that it's not some specific person that is meant. This is the way they understand it in the Hindu mythology. And so, cherish the devas. So again, so if you now please the devas with these offerings, then in turn devas will be pleased with you. And that's why when there is no rain, then people will say, oh, let us do some Varuna Japam and all these services. And let me please the devas, and in turn the devas will give. What it shows is again the interrelatedness between the microcosm and the macrocosm. Now when it gets expressed through mythology, it sounds like just a bunch of superstition, a bunch of like, who are these, what they worshipping? But the principle behind it is to recognize that no one, that we are all dependent on one another. That we as individuals, we are dependent on the cosmic forces. And that so long as all of this lives in harmony, life will be smooth and peaceful. That is what is said here. Verse 12. You can see that Sri Ramakrishna's quote that is given is wonderful. Whatever you offer to the Lord is returned to you magnified manifold. Take care therefore that you do not offer anything bad of Him. Whatever you come will be thousandfold returned to you. Verse 12. Ishtan bhogan hivo devan.
Ishtan bhogan hivo devan.
Dasyante yajna bhavitaha.
Dasyante yajna bhavitaha.
Tair datta na pradayaibhyo.
Tair datta na pradayaibhyo.
Yo bhunte stena eva saha.
Yo bhunte stena eva saha.
Cherished by Yajna, the Deva shall bestow on you the enjoyment you desire. A thief verily is he who enjoys what is given by them without returning them anything. This is what I was saying. When things come to you and you say, I am the only one going to enjoy, I am not giving to anybody else. And such a person is called, you are really a thief. Because you are getting from outside but you don't want to share. So that kind of behavior is condemned. Verse 13. Yajna shishta shinas santo.
Yajna shishta shinas santo.
Muchante sarva kil vishaihi.
Muchante sarva kil vishaihi.
Bhunjate te tvakham papa.
Bhunjate te tvakham papa.
Ye pachantyatma karanat.
Ye pachantyatma karanat.
The good who eat the remains of yajna are freed from all sins. But the sinful ones who cook food only for themselves, they verily eat sin. Again, condemnation of all selfishness. The more, and it's wonderful actually, this, just imagine, if this idea becomes or is practiced, or people become conscious of it more and more in the world, so many problems can be solved. The great problem of inequality in the world, that so few people have, or so few people consume so much of the world's resources, while there are many who don't even have the minimum that they require. Now again, with this idea of yajna, people will say, why can I not use or consume as much as I need and then share with others what I have surplus? But that's not what is happening. So those who have more get more, and those who have less remain less. And that's why the gulf between the rich and the poor is widening. The gulf between the literate and the illiterate is widening. And this inequality is the cause of all problems in the world. Because then those who have less are going to be envious of those who have more. And at some point they are just going to get desperate, and so you have all this theft and violence. And this happens not just at the individual level, it can happen at the collective level. And that's how you have these wars taking place. So those who are powerful want to remain powerful and not allow any competition from others. So you see, this inequality is the root of all evil. And unfortunately, because the way our mind is set up, we want to kind of perpetuate this inequality everywhere. I mean, even some of the Hindu ideas or Vaishnava ideas of the heaven. So they say there are many kinds of muktis. And they say sarupya, samipya, sayujya, and so on. That is, depending on the amount of punyam you have, depending on the amount of devotion you have, then some people will be closer to God, some people will get the God's form, or some people will get, and so on. Which really creates a difficulty, which means, is then heaven, would heaven be really a place full of joy? I don't think so, because then we are created this distinction. It's like, you say, oh, New York is the commercial capital world. But commercial capital is okay. It doesn't mean that everyone in New York is a millionaire. There are homeless people even in New York, and there are people who are extremely wealthy in New York. So, but they are all living in New York. Doesn't mean that they all are equally happy. The same thing is going to happen in heaven too. Because then there are people who have done a lot of good things, and the people who have done a little bit of good thing. And then obviously people who have done a lot of good thing will have extra privileges in heaven. They, maybe they have an apartment closer to the Lord. And others will say, oh, you stay in some long, far away somewhere. You have to commute a long distance to go and serve the Lord. And the people who are staying far away are going to be jealous of these people. They say, why? Why should these people get all privileges? They get to see the Lord more often than we do. So the same mindset that we have here, I mean, essentially, who are the presidents of heaven? Same people who are here are going to go there. And so the mind is not going to change. So we are just going to create another messy world there. And that's why heaven is never seen in the Vedantic tradition as a goal worth striving for. Just a duplication of the world, a duplication of life here. And that's what is referred to here. When it is said that the good who eat the remains of yajna are freed from all sin, the sinful ones who cook food only for themselves verily eat sin. And that is why, so if we become selfish, then that selfishness will show itself. Wherever you are, whether here or in heaven, it won't make any difference. In fact, the devas are, in Tulsi Ramayana, Tulsidas makes so much fun of these devas. The devas are little bit like the super delegates. You see, essentially you can't depend on the super delegates, because whoever is the winning horse,
they are
flip-floppers. Yeah, because essentially they are career politicians, they have to think about their future. So a lot of them will kind of wait till the end and then see who is the likelihood. But then they can, if they kind of win, if they can back a winning horse, then of course there is something in return they will get. You see, what is the point in backing someone who is going to lose? They say, when in Ramayana, when the final great war started between Rama and Ravana, big, and Rama is sending his arrows and Ravana is sending his arrows, and many of these devas from the heaven, they are watching all this thing happening. They are simply saying, Jai, Jai, Jai. They are not saying, who is Jai? Jai Ho, Jai Ho. The idea is, then let me see who is winning. Suppose Ravana would be winning, they will say, Ravan ki jai. If Rama is winning, Ram ki jai. But in the beginning, they are just like sitting on the fence. Because essentially, they just want to continue staying in heaven. They don't care who wins. So, how is that? Because if this kind of selfish people, it's not that selfish people don't do good things. There are a lot of people who do a lot of charitable acts. But the charitable acts are done not out of love for the person. But if I do this, then I will go to heaven. So here these people are more in love with themselves than with the people. So this helping other people is only a means towards some goal which will give them joy. You see, so that is, so they are selfish. But so it's good to remember that a lot of apparent good is being done by selfish people. But if that mental makeup is selfish, then even when they go there, they are not like suddenly now, okay, I'll switch off my selfishness. It doesn't happen. So they are going to be selfish even there. And then that is what is referred. So such people cannot be happy even when they go to heaven. So that is referred to in verse number 13. Then let's go to 14. 14 refers to that wheel of life that I spoke about earlier. Annat bhavanti bhutani.
Annat bhavanti bhutani.
Parjanya danna sambhavaha.
Parjanya danna sambhavaha.
Yajnat bhavati parjanyo.
Yajnat bhavati parjanyo.
Yajna karma samudbhavaha.
Yajna karma samudbhavaha.
From food beings become, from rain is food produced, from yajna rain proceeds, yajna is born of karma. So you see the circle. So this comes from this, this comes from this, this comes from that, and the circle gets complete. 15. Karma brahmodbhavam vidhi.
Karma brahmodbhavam vidhi.
Brahma akshara samudbhavam.
Brahma akshara samudbhavam.
Tasmat sarvagatam brahma.
Tasmat sarvagatam brahma.
Nityam yajne pratishthitam.
Nityam yajne pratishthitam.
No karma to have risen from the Veda, and the Veda from the imperishable. The all-pervading Veda is therefore ever centered in yajna. So it is an, you can see, if you can kind of later on a sheet of paper, just see the chain reaction. How from the Vedas, from the imperishable, that is the Akshara, from the Lord come the Vedas, from the Vedas came karma, and from karma the yajna is born, from yajna the rain comes, and from the rain food comes, and from the food we come. And then we do karma, and then it just again completes the whole circle that way. Then verse 16. Evam pravartitam chakram.
Evam pravartitam chakram.
Nanu vartayati hayaha.
Nanu vartayati hayaha.
Akhayur indriya ramo.
Akhayur indriya ramo.
Mogham partha sachivati.
Mogham partha sachivati.
He who does not follow on earth the wheel, thus revolving, sinful of life and rejoicing in the senses, he, O Partha, lives in vain. So if we do not follow this cycle of yajna, then our life is wasted. We don't, the happiness, the peace, the joy, the fulfillment that we seek will never come to us if we don't recognize this cosmic yajna that is continually going on and participate in that yajna willingly. As I said, we really don't have any choice in the matter. If we don't participate willingly, we'll be made to participate forcibly. Then why not do it willingly? That's the because if you do it willingly and joyfully, then the peace and harmony that we all seek will come. If you don't do it, you'll be forced to do it, but it'll be kicking and crying and this thing, you have to still give it away. So that's what happens to people. We till the end people say, I won't give, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine. And then some situation occurs in life, whether it's old age or quarreling relatives or a stock market crash or just anything, And everything that we click is like gone. That means nothing remains. So participating in yajna is a way for a true happy life. Now, of course, the next set of verses will show that the Atman is not affected by all of this. So what is involved in yajna is what is a part of this creation. And a part of this creation is our body, mind, ego, which is as much a part of this creation as the tree and the lawn and the mountain and the rain. So all of this, you see, Swami Vivekananda once said, look at the ocean, not the waves. The more we are able to look at the ocean, the more peaceful we become. If you see, you don't have an ocean here, do you? Nearby? Oh, so too bad. That's why you must come to Boston, you will see. So if you go to the ocean, you see normally, actually even, you've got beautiful sky here. If you look at things which are huge, it settles the mind down, you see. The more we remain confined in narrow spaces, then the mind also becomes small. That is sometimes just good to go out and just look at the sky or look at the ocean, because the expansion of consciousness occurs when you look at these infinite, well, it's not really infinite, but much, much bigger than our normal things we are dealing with. Everything is so limited entities we deal with most of the time. A wave is a part of the ocean. But if a wave acquires an ego and says, I am a wave, I have nothing to do with the ocean. But essentially, wave is so fragile. Wave is a wave as long as it has a wave form. But essentially, wave is nothing. The water of the wave is same as the water of the ocean. But look, the waves say, there are many waves in the ocean. And suppose these waves start fighting with each other. I am bigger than you. I am more beautiful than you. And then it's really silly, because essentially just the ocean. The only thing real in all of that is the water of the ocean. That's the only thing real. But because the wave has a specific form, then waves acquire ego and say, no, I am like this, I am like that. And one day they are all going to subside and just become the ocean. That's really our condition. Say at the physical level, what is a human body? When a human being dies, and say when a dog dies or when a tree dies and you burn them all, you have three heaps of ashes. You cannot distinguish which is a human ash or a tree ash or a dog ash. So as far as the physical thing is concerned, there's absolutely no difference. So this is made up of the same, you can find the chemical composition of the human body and chemical composition of everything, the same atoms and molecules, everything is same. But if you say, no, this is different, so I'm kind of looking at this wave of the human body, is comparing itself with the other waves and saying, I am like this, I am like that. Well, essentially, all are just the water of the ocean. So if it's possible to look upon the entire world as an ocean of matter, and our bodies and every material object is only a wave in that ocean. And if you look at that ocean, say, I am, even physically, it's not just that we are one spiritually. Even physically, we are really one. I mean, there is really no gap. Because I might think that this is me and this is the chair, but there is no gap, because in between there is air. And air also is made of atoms and molecules. So there are atoms and molecules here, there are atoms and molecules here, there are atoms and molecules here. Only in a different configuration and held together by different forces, that's all. But essentially, it's all one continuous ocean of matter, in which certain objects have acquired their ego and say, this is my body, this is yours. We're just different waves. So there is this ocean of matter and our bodies are only waves in it. Similarly, there is an ocean of ideas. So my own little mind, I think, oh, this is my idea, these are my thoughts, and your mind. So again, Each individual mind is like a small wave, and the whole cosmic mind is one big ocean. Similarly with the Atman, I have my own little soul. Everybody has a little own soul. Again, each of these so-called individual souls are only a wave. There is this one supreme soul in which all are united. So look at the ocean, not the wave. It's a way our littleness will go away and we will truly become infinite. So the Atman is not affected by all of this. All this yajna talk is only for these body, mind and things like that. So the next set of verses will show that the Atman is completely unaffected by all of this. So now if you have any thoughts or ideas or questions up to verse 16.